Have a seat. Well, good morning. Good to have you here. Typically, you know, when I think of June and July, second service, by the time I'm getting up to speak, there's been so many people in here. It's like 30 degrees in here already. And I'm looking out and you're all trying to stay awake in the midst of the heat. So we took that excuse away. How's that? Great to have the air conditioning. We're just grateful for everyone who did so much to make our little sojourn into the hospitality area there for a while go well. So grateful for that. Before we get to the message, tonight is our congregational meeting. And this is our annual meeting where we'll look at our budget for next year. Now, a lot of times people see budget as a financial document, but it is only that secondarily. First and foremost, a budget, it's about vision. It's about what do we think God wants us to do? And what's that going to take? And so tonight, that's what we're going to look at. Pastoral team, we're going to share a little bit of what's on their heart and what they're excited about as we look at the 2023-2024 ministry year. That's kind of an odd thing to think about, 2024. Wow. So encourage you to come out for that and be a part of that conversation. Now, as I share that, I do that with some very encouraging news and some very challenging news this morning. On an encouraging note, this whole redo of our facility almost 10 years ago now, it cost us about $8 million at one point. I think the highest our budget was about $4.5 million. This week, we crossed the threshold and we now owe less than $1 million on this whole thing. And we're just really, really grateful for how God has provided. So continue to pray as we see that come down some more. Now, the challenging news, as we look at next year tonight, we also look at the end of our fiscal year that ends on June 30th. And as we look at the end of the year, and this is in your program, and look at what we think we're going to need, we think we're going to need about $250,000 over the next few weeks until June 30th. And that's a lot. And we're behind. Great to see what our mission budget is doing. Only need about 10 grand there. But in our general operating, we're looking at over 250 grand. And what do we do with that? We pray. God is a provider. So I'm just asking us, as those who call McKern in their home, if we would pray. Say, God, you provide. You know our needs. Would you provide? And as we pray, to say, God, would there be any part you'd have me doing this? And we just trust God, because he's a God who meets our needs. So we just want to make you aware of that this morning. Well, as we turn to our message now, this last Thursday was an amazing day here at our church. We honored the life of a very dear saint who called McKernan Baptist her home. Her name was Trudy Schatz, and she spent almost 35 years of her life on the mission field in Cameroon. The picture on the left, she's probably around 30 there, graduated as a nurse. And it's interesting. I read her story in an old denominational magazine this week. And in the story, here she is, 30, 31 years old, getting on a boat in New York and taking a boat over to Africa. There is no Wi-Fi on that boat. I mean, There's nothing on that boat. There is no FaceTime with any of her family. And there she went in 1959. And the impact she's had on people. I had a chance to be in the Cameroon in 1998. And she already retired, and I was on a prayer team. And we went all over the country to the mission field and the various things. You know, and at first I'm a member of the prayer team, but then they find out that I am the pastor of the church that Trudy Schatz goes to. And all of a sudden, it's like, I'm a rock star, right? It was weird. And you just see the legacy of this lady. So I'm thinking back to Thursday. And I go from this memorial service, which all these tributes, and it's unbelievable. And I go to my office, and I'm working on today's message, which is about what does it look like when We give the pen of our lives to God as the author. And as I'm doing that, thinking, how do I introduce my sermon? It's kind of like, duh, the Spirit of God is saying, show some of the tributes. So I want to begin today with showing you a tribute that came from the Cameroon, where Trudy served so many years. She never married, never had her own children, and yet how many of her students did she reach out to as a Ma? She was called by many Ma Trudy. One of her daughters, one that really became close to her, is a lady named Florence, who's a dentist over there now. And just to set up the tribute I'm going to show you, Florence is in the middle. She's got this little choir that has been singing this tribute. And next to her is a guy named Walter. Walter is Florence's husband. He's a missionary in the area of finances over in Cameroon. So they got married. And Trudy is like their mom. And so Walter is sharing some of the legacy of Trudy over in Cameroon. And you'll hear Florence share his heart. And then they give a little musical tribute. But I thought it was so powerful that you just kind of need to be part of it too. So let's share that.
I'm Walter Grob here with my wife Florence and a group called Psalms Alive. We're here to give tribute to Ma Trudy Schatz. Ma Trudy first came to Cameroon in 1959. And she touched many lives here, serving as a nurse midwife at Bonso Baptist Hospital. She was the midwife who delivered Florence and many other children. In the mid-1980s, she was assigned as a pioneer chief of center of a Tugabe Baptist Health Center in the capital city, Yaoundé. This was one of the first significant ministries of the Cameroon Baptist Convention Health Services in this French-speaking part of Cameroon, and now it's a hospital. After that, she moved back to Bonso, where she trained healthcare personnel at the private training school for health personnel until her retirement. Trudy was known for being very diligent, and especially wanted things clean, and if you didn't keep them clean, she let you know it. Florence's father served as Trudy's cook, and Trudy acted as a second mother to Florence. In fact, when I wanted to ask for Florence's hand in marriage, I had to ask not only Florence's father, but also Trudy. We are thankful to all who cared for Trudy in her final years. Betty Mante, Milton and Lori, and Ingrid, and the Alberta healthcare system. News of her passing touched many people here in Cameroon. And Quan Jacob, the principal of the training school for health personnel, and G. Richard, the Bonso Baptist Hospital administrator who served with Trudy in Bonso. Phi Bridget, who was someone that Trudy mentored, and Zach Yongwa, a longtime worker at the Atugabe Baptist Health Center. Another person who was really touched was Peter Kakute, and I want to share what he shared concerning Trudy. He said, "It is with a very heavy heart that I received the sad news of our beloved Trudy Schatz. I thought of her a few days ago. I have been her student in the ward auxiliary. Ward auxiliaries are people who help nurses in the hospitals. And I've been her student in the nursing school at Bonso Baptist Hospital. We celebrate her life and the legacy she left us of integrity and commitment to serving our Master Jesus." There's no better tribute than that. Someone who's left a legacy of integrity and commitment to serving our Master Jesus. We're so thankful for Trudy's life.
I am who I am today because of you, Ma Trudy. Your sacrifices are more than words can express. Above all, your faith in service to the Lord and to the people of Cameroon has left an indelible mark in our lives. Coming to Edmonton will never be the same again. I miss you deeply, Ma Trudy. But I know you're resting in the bosom of the Lord. Ma Betty. Thank you, Milton. Just remember, you have a sister in Cameroon. We will never forget your sacrifices to all of us here. In that great getting up morning, we will meet to part no more. Goodbye, Mama.
Seen that 5-6 times, I still choke up every time. I think of that video, and they end with this last chapter that we so entrust to God, put our faith in God for our eternity. But the thing about Trudy's life is that's not all. She gave every chapter in so many ways. She lifted the pen of her life to God and said, God, I don't want you to just write the last chapter. Write all the chapters. And so here's a godly woman saying, I am who I am today because of what you did through that woman. Isn't that amazing? And another of her nursing students wrote an email that was shared on Thursday. And she said, you have many, many good seeds here in Cameroon. And I know it's not even that. When she retired and was here for probably 20 years after retirement before she got ill, she's involved in international students. You know, this 70, 80 year old woman just saying, God, today, what does this look like? And I just think of that story because I think it's contrasted so much to where we kind of live, where we're always wanting to be something else, right? Like, we live in a world that says, you can be whatever you're going to be. You're the one who determines it. It all comes from you. And it leads to this drivenness. I can't help but think of a little story I read about a pilot. And as he's flying, different co-pilots notice that on this domestic route, he always kind of makes sure he's looking down at one point all the time, whenever they go over this area. And so finally, one of the co-pilots says, what are you doing? And he said, well, that's where I grew up. When I was a kid, I'd sit down there, right by that stream, on that log, and I would fish. And every time a plane flew over, I would look up and I'd say, I wish I were flying. Now I look down and I say, I wish I were fishing. And I think this is such a picture of life. Because we don't anymore acknowledge a God who has a script for our life and it's good and a plan, we try and make our own plan. So, when I'm just done high school, I'll get to school and then I'll go to that and I'll go to this and I'll do this. But then, I don't know where I'll work. I could go there or there or there. And we just drive ourselves and we're looking around at where everyone else is at. And I got to be a little bit better. It's crazy making. And it raises the question, are we designed to write our own story or to surrender to the story God's writing? This morning, we're starting a series in the life of David. And it is a story of God having a plan for a person and David surrendering to it. But it's a very authentic story. I love what Eugene Peterson writes about David. He says, David's isn't an ideal life, it's an actual life. When we meet King David in the Bible, there are some great chapters that are going good and he's doing well. Some are bad. David is serving God, but it's hard. Some are just plain ugly because David is real and there's times he takes the pen back. And we're going to see some of those stories. But it seems he always in the end gives it back to God. And we see this authentic life lived out. And today I want to start in the beginning. The first time we meet David is in 1 Samuel 16. His name shows up in a genealogy in Ruth, but the very first time we meet him is 1 Samuel 16. And the context is when he's actually chosen to be king. Long before he'll ascend to the throne, he's a young boy. Very much in obscurity. We're going to see very much the youngest of his family and very much the runt of the litter and very much even in that family assigned to the sheep, the smelly sheep. Just the youngest, just the runt of the litter. And yet instead of fight it, he leans into what God is up to. Okay? So if we pick up the story in 1 Samuel 16, Samuel is the judge. There is a king, his name is Saul, but Samuel is the one God talks to. And earlier, Samuel had appointed Saul as judge, but Saul turned from God, and God has, because of that, rejected him and his line as the kingly line, and now he's going to appoint another king. So, verse 1, chapter 16, the Lord said to Samuel, how long will you mourn for Saul, since I've rejected him as king over Israel? Fill your horn with oil, be on your way. I'm sending you to Jesse of Bethlehem. I've chosen one of his sons to be king. But Samuel said, how can I go? If Saul hears about me, he'll kill me. Yeah. See, this is what happens. Saul no longer served God. He didn't want to do the kingship the way God wanted. He wanted to take control, and he took control of his life. And when we do that, do you see the paranoia? Do you see the protection? Even Samuel is going, this is not good when someone is living off of God's script. All right. The Lord said, take a heifer with you and say, I've come to sacrifice to the Lord. Invite Jesse to the sacrifice. Okay, there's a father in Bethlehem. Invite him to the sacrifice and I'll show you what to do. You're to anoint for me the one I indicate. Samuel did what the Lord said. When he arrived at Bethlehem, the elders of the town trembled when they met him. They asked, do you come in peace? Samuel's got quite the reputation, okay? Samuel replied, yes, I come in peace. I've come to sacrifice to the Lord. Consecrate yourselves and come to the sacrifice with me. Then he consecrated Jesse and his sons and invited them to the sacrifice. Do you see that bottom part? Samuel invites all of Jesse's sons to come and be part of this, and we can only imagine in the midst of it, he's saying to Jesse, God is going to choose one of your sons as the next king, so invite them all. And that's what you would assume Jesse would do, but as the story goes on, and maybe you know it, one by one by one, from the oldest to the youngest, these sons come, and each one, God is just not giving Samuel the green light until all seven are done, and I'm sure you've got Samuel shaking his head going, I told you all your sons. God said, one of your sons. What's going on here? Verse 10. Jesse had seven of his sons pass before Samuel, but Samuel said to him, the Lord hasn't chosen these. So he asked Jesse, this is the only other option here. Are these all the sons you have? Am I missing something? God, are you missing something? What's going on? Here's Jesse's answer. There is still the youngest. He answered, and he's tending the sheep. He wasn't even counted worthy to be one of the sons to invite to the whole thing. You get that? He's the runt of the litter. He's the youngest. We've assigned him to the smelliest, worst job in the family. And obviously, God isn't going to choose him. Just the youngest, just the runt, just the obscure. Eugene Peterson, in his book on the life of David, he says, David is the basic biblical rebuke to the minimizing adjective just. You see, when we take the pen from God's hand and want to write our own script, we want to overcome all of that just and make a name for ourselves where God meets us in the just because he's made us just the way we are, and it's pretty amazing. And in this story now, we start to see how God is writing a story and he's inviting a family. David specifically, but even the brothers, are they going to cooperate or fight against what God is doing? And so it's a story of the choice of David, but the way ancient Hebrews told stories, they often use contrast. We want to show you what's going on in David's life, but we're going to contrast it to what's going on in Jesse's life and Samuel's life and the brother's life, okay? And what's going on in David's life is God's looking at the heart. That's verse 7. The Lord said to Samuel, "Do not consider his appearance or his height, for I've rejected him. The Lord does not look at these things that people look at. People look at outward appearance. The Lord looks at the heart." And there's so much we could say about what God sees in the heart, but one of the huge things God saw is David had a heart that said, "Okay, God, I might be out in the sheepfold. I might be just the youngest, but I'm giving you the pen, you write." And the brothers are saying, "I'm the oldest. Look what I got. I'm going to write my own way." So let's talk about this contrast. We're going to start by looking at how does Samuel and Jesse see life? And we'll contrast that to how David sees life, all right? So Samuel and Jesse, how do they see life? They see life through eyes of achievement and comparison. All right, I'm a little bit bigger, I'm a little bit better. We'll focus here on Eliab. Now, Jesse, when he looked at his sons and heard one of them was going to be king, obviously he was going to be the firstborn. And in that culture, the firstborn was everything. Not only that, but it seems Eliab was pretty tall, pretty good looking. You read between the lines, Eliab's got kind of the swagger. He's the guy, if you're going to play King of the Hill, you want to pick him first. Actually, whatever sport, you want to pick Eliab first. All the externals are there. And Samuel buys into that view too. So we come to verse 6. All right. "When they arrived, Samuel saw Eliab and thought, 'Surely the Lord's anointed stands here before the Lord.'" He's going to lead off the batting order. He's the king of our King of the Hill team. He's got it all together. Verse 7, "But the Lord said to Samuel, 'Don't consider his appearance or his height, for I've rejected him. The Lord does not look at the things people look at. People look at outward appearance, but the Lord looks at the heart.'" What God did not see in Eliab was a heart that was willing to surrender. Now, what's interesting about Eliab, we start to see this as we keep going in the story. Here in chapter 16, we don't see Eliab's response, but we see it in chapter 17. We're going to look at chapter 17 next week. It's a story of David and Goliath, but I want to pull out a little chunk right now. And it's a chunk where David is sent. It's funny, even after he's anointed king, where does he go right away? Back to the sheep field. And he's just doing his thing in the sheep field. There's a war with the Philistines. The three older brothers get to go, and they're part of the army. So they're their Philistine army. That's where they meet Goliath. And Jesse says to the youngest, to the runt of the litter, probably still not figuring out how he got anointed, "Can you at least take a care package to your brothers?" So he does that. David takes this care package. He hears about the Philistine army and Goliath, and he's trying to figure out, why are you so afraid? What's going on here? Word comes to Eliab that David has come and he's asking questions. Here's a response. "When Eliab, David's oldest brother, heard David speaking with the men, he burned with anger at him." Why was he angry? I think he's angry because he's resentful. It could have been so different. Couldn't Eliab have said, "My little brother just got anointed to be the next king. I get to be part of something God's doing in the nation, and our family's part of it." And couldn't have he almost been excited when David got there and said, "David, you've been anointed king. What's God saying to you?" No. Because when we write our own script, we got to one up. We got to compare, we got to protect, we got to control. It's up to me. That makes me competitive, that makes me strive, that makes me driven, that makes me anxious. You see it all here. How different Had Eliab been able to accept the fact that God has chosen my brother, so God, as the older brother of the one you've chosen to be king, what do you have for me? You wonder how different it could have been. If instead of being discontent and having it to be different so that I can have life, saying, God, this is the opportunity, these are the gifts, these are the skills, this is how you've made me, what does it look like to live for you now instead of living my whole life for if only, and all of that. And let me illustrate this. I read a story this week by a guy named Russell Conwell. He was a pastor in the mid to late 1800s and in Philadelphia, and actually became one of the founders and the first president of what's now Temple University. Had very Christian roots, that university. One of the stories that he continually told his students, and actually, as I've got to kind of read about this story, he told often in his travels, is called An Acre of Diamonds. The story of the Acre of Diamonds, as he tells it, begins when he took a trip to the Middle East. And this is the late 1800s. You don't just go. You need guides and all of that. So he found a local guide to kind of take him around some areas. And this local guide, this local Arab guide, loved to tell stories to the point that Russell Conwell was almost tired of them until this story came, and it became profound for him. It is the story, as the guide told it, of someone named Ali Hafed. Ali Hafed, according to the story, was a very wealthy man. He owned a large farm. It had orchards and grain fields and gardens, and he was a wealthy and content man. Until one day. One day, a guest came along and told Ali Hafed about a diamond. He'd never heard of a diamond before, but if you heard of a diamond, this incredibly precious and rare stone, and if you just had a diamond, you would be wealthy beyond your imagining. Well, as the guide told the story, he said that night, Ali Hafed, for the first time, went to bed a poor man. Poor out of discontent, poor out of no longer being able to live in the situation he was in. He had to have the diamond. So the next morning he said to the guests, "Where do I find the diamond?" And the guest said, "Well, you have to look. You got to go after it." Ali Hafed sold his farm and gave his life to find the diamond, going from one country to another land, to another land, and he never, ever found it. He traveled the world over. Finally, becoming so poor, broken, and defeated, he committed suicide. And with that, the Arab guy went and got something going on an area over here, and there's Russell Conwell going, "That can't be the end of the story." So he said, "You know, it's not. Here's the next chapter of the story." Back at the farm that Ali Hafed sold, the new owner one day took his camel for a drink in the brook. And as the camel is getting a drink, there's a kind of something reflecting, and he dug, and he found this clear stone, kind of brilliant and beautiful. Didn't know what it was, but that's kind of cool. I'm going to put it on my mantle at home. That's what he did. Well, it's on the mantle, and a while later, this original guest who told Ali Hafed about the diamond came and visited this man, and as soon as he saw the rock, he said, "Has Ali Hafed come home? Did he find the diamond?" The guy said, "Well, no, Ali Hafed is dead." "And what's a diamond?" And the guest said, "Well, that's a diamond. Do you know what that's worth?" "No." "Where'd you find it?" And they went back to the brook and they dug a little more. "There's another one, there's another one, there's another one." And pretty soon they realized they're sitting on acres of diamonds. The old Arab guide paused at that point. He said, "Had Ali Hafed remained at home and dug in his own garden, he would have had acres of diamonds instead of experiencing death in a strange land." Wow. For Russell Conwell, this follower of Jesus, it became much more than a story about diamonds. It became a story about who writes our script. am I willing to receive from God his plan for me? The identity, he says, which is amazing. I'm loved, I'm forgiven, I'm gifted. He is working around me. Am I willing to just receive that and say, God, in this situation, without always living for the next step, if only then I'll get my act together, then life will make sense. No, right now. Am I willing to go deeper with God and let him determine where life goes and its breadth and all of that? I can't imagine at the age of 31, Trudy Schatz getting on a boat saying someday there's going to be a clinic in Yaoundé that I started. That there's going to be many, many, many lives who look to me as Ma. She never set out to do that. Just how do I follow you, God? How you've made me. And look what he did. And so that begins to give us to the other side of the foil. We've seen that for Jesse and how he looked at things, and Eliab and Samuel, it was external appearances, achievement, comparison, and it was actually, in many ways, life-destroying, numbing. So what about David? How did David see? And when we look at the story, I'd like to suggest that David saw quite differently. He saw through eyes of acceptance, surrender. We go back to chapter 16. We come to verse 11. Samuel asked Jesse, "Are these all your sons?" "Oh, they're still the youngest," Jesse answered, "but he's tending sheep." Samuel said, "Well, send for him. We will not sit down until he arrives." So he sent for him and had him brought in. Now, what would be very reasonable to read next is this. David came in, and boy, was he ticked. How could they leave him out? How could they do that? Or to read, David knew that they were against him, so he had spies, and there were his friends who knew this was going on, and they told him, and he came in, and he was ticked. No. I don't read that. It's an argument from silence, but still, we don't see David striving. He's the runt of the litter. He's the youngest. He's put out in the sheep field because no one else would do it. And you know what? He didn't fight it. Now, he didn't passively, "Oh, I'm a victim," but he said, "This is where I'm at right now. How do I get to know God here?" And you see this. What happens as a result? He sent for him, had him brought in. He was glowing with health and had fine appearance and handsome features. I thought that glowing with health. There's something on the inside. He's okay, and it's showing on the outside. So Samuel took the horn of oil and anointed him in the presence of his brothers. Wow. Samuel, or David took the time to go deep with God in the midst of where he was, and God determined the breadth of where his influence would be. How often do we do it the other way? I want to determine the breadth, and we don't have the character to sustain it, and we just keep being discontent. How do we know David went deeper with God while he was in the sheep field? I'd like to suggest there's two answers to that. One is the poems that he wrote, and the other is the stories that he told. The poems, the songs that he wrote, we see this in verse 23. Again, it's kind of odd. David is anointed king. Saul can't know that yet because it's going to be trouble. So he doesn't even know this about David. But Saul, because he's following his own script and it's fallen apart, he's going crazy inside. And one of the only things that can help is if someone comes and plays music for him. And there's this message of this obscure little shepherd boy who's written songs. So they go find him and they take him to David. And in verse 23, 1 Samuel 16, whenever the Spirit from God came on Saul, okay, so he's ticked, he's angry, David would take up his lyre, his harp, and play. And then relief would come to Saul. There's something about the music of David that connected with God. It's very possible. There are 73 of 150 Psalms that have the little title of David. 73. And how many are the unpublished collection of David, right? Someone's still waiting to find those albums in his attic. David, while he's in obscurity, is looking up into the heavens at the God who made him and made this world. And he's going deeper with him. And some of those psalms cry out a sense of need. Some of those psalms cry out a sense of praise. But God met him and he knew his God more deeply as he spent time to go deep with God rather than want to work on his own breath. Okay, so that's the songs that he wrote. Then what about the stories he told? There's a great story around the David and Goliath thing. And if you know the David and Goliath story, you know it. David and Goliath, we're going to talk next week, but there's this giant coming up against Israel, Goliath. David says, well, why doesn't anyone trust God and go up against him? I'll do it. Saul, the king, again, doesn't know David's anointed, saying, here's a young boy, what can you do? And David says, well, you know, I've been a shepherd. There's been like lions and bears, tigers, oh my. Oh, that's Wizard of Oz. There's been lions and bears come up against the sheep. And you know what? God help me kill them. We'll pick up the story, chapter 17, verse 36. Your servant, David, has killed both the lion and the bear. This uncircumcised Philistine will be like one of them because he's defied the armies of the living God. Verse 37 is huge. The Lord who rescued me from the paw of the lion and the paw of the bear will rescue me from the hand of the Philistine. David was the one with the knife in his hand, but he said it's God who did it. Did you see that? Even how he tells his stories is not, look what I did. I killed a lion and a bear. I could kill the giant. He said, no, God killed a lion and a bear. He can kill the giant. See that? That's huge. In his obscurity, David is getting closer to God, getting to know God, growing his faith in God, so that when the challenges of kingship come, the depth is there. Because he's not out living in some striving kind of opportunities he's trying to create for himself. But he's saying, God, what does it look like for me to live for you right here? And let you lead the next opportunities. Right now where you're at, you got a pen. Maybe you're in school. And on the one hand, you're like, boy, when I just get out of school, life will begin. No, right now, what does God want to do to you in school? Beyond school. Oh, we want to grab the pen. I want that job because there's money in that job and there's advancement in that job and all of that. Well, God, what job do you have for me? I think a lot of us, you know, even as sometimes young families, we have young kids, and oh, we just want them to grow up, because it's, and God might be saying, what about right now? What are the opportunities right now? Oh, when I just retire, I'm writing my retirement plans, and God said, live now. Give me the script now. Or we get to our retirement and because we've written the script and there's no one around anymore to affirm the script, we feel so empty. God's saying, now it's time. Give each of your days to me. See, when we do that, what happens? Verse 13, back to 1 Samuel 16. So Samuel took the horn of oil and anointed him in the presence of his brothers, and from that day on, the Spirit of the Lord came powerfully upon David. Bible's clear, when we come to Christ, we have a relationship with him, his Spirit fills us. But as long as we're writing the script, we can't expect the power of the Spirit to empower our own agenda. The Spirit of God comes upon his agenda through us. And he starts to work in ways that we can't imagine. And a young pastor's daughter from the prairies can have an amazing impact on many people because the Spirit of God worked through her. See, that's the life that matters. So today, right now, each one of us in this room, we're holding a pen. We have a choice what to do with it. When you say, God, each day of my life, I can wake up and say it's yours. When I face big decisions, I can say it's yours. Or I can say, well, let me look around. I want to write a little bit bigger picture than the people I see and build my own identity and purpose. It's crazy making. I've been there. I'm vulnerable to it. I know it. And I wrestle with it myself. But the truth that David tells us, the story tells us, is that freedom, the fullness of the life God has for us, chapters that find meaning prior to the final chapter that's going to be amazing, they come when we take the pen and we say, God, you write my story. Let's pray. God, it's so easy to want the pen. It's even hard, I think, a lot of times to know how to let go of the pen because it's just so ingrained in our culture. This lie that you make yourself whatever you want to be, and then we wonder why anxiety and fear and all of this stuff is higher than we've ever seen it in our culture. And you say, no, how about instead of making your own way, you receive the way that God has for you, and you walk in it in freedom. God, in the quiet of this time, may we see the pen we're holding. And God, would you reveal to us scripts that we don't want you to write because we're so busy writing them for ourselves? Show them to us. Show us where they're destroying us. As we hear your invitation to simply give you the pen and lay down those scripts and let you again be the author of our lives. I'm going to sing it. I lift up my hands, lay my whole life down. Thank you that in that prayer is not only life, but the open gate to your Spirit to work in and through us in ways we can't imagine. God, thank you for the beauty of your story. Grant us courage to follow you in it. Let's stand together.